Chapter 7. Political bribery decriminalized. Vote buying as free speech. There is only scant evidence that independent expenditures ever ingratiate. Justice Anthony Kennedy, Majority Opinion in Citizens United, 2010. In the last 9 years, 6 Buckley-genre Supreme Court decisions have wreaked havoc on the nation's campaign finance laws, opening the door to super PACs and corporate spending, creating new channels for wealthy donors and candidates to influence elections, and weakening programs meant to lower barriers for ordinary Americans to run for office. Brennan Center for Justice, New York University Law School, 2016. Frank Capra's greatest film was Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Andy Barr is no Mr. Smith. As a newly elected member of Congress in 2012, Andy Barr really hit the ground running. Before he had even been sworn in, Andy, a former lobbyist from Kentucky, had a decidedly odd fundraiser for a freshman congressman. It was co-sponsored by a powerful K Street lobbyist, whose clients included financial firms like Bank of America and MasterCard International. It was held at the upscale Charlie Palmer Steakhouse, within sight of the Capitol, a decidedly glitzy setting for soliciting campaign contributions for a new congressman. The crowd was heavy on financial industry lobbyists, including powerful donors like the American Bankers Association and PNC Bank. How did the neophyte Andy earn such a celebrated welcome to Washington? It turns out that Andy is a very lucky young man. The 40-year-old freshman Republican had won a coveted appointment to the House Financial Services Committee. There was intense bank industry pressure to jump Barr over more than 100 more senior GOP members of Congress, covetous of that slot, and the GOP leadership wilted. The industry had obviously concluded Barr was theirs. And Andy? Well, he may not appreciate the complexities of banking, but he certainly knows the secret of success in Washington. The Financial Services Committee controls banking regulations, making it the primo spot on Capitol Hill for attracting campaign cash from the richest of all U.S. industries. Andy may be clueless about CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, but not about the key to a long career in the Buckley era of American politics. You might think of folks like Andy as public servants, but the donor class thinks of politicians like him as an investment, and Andy was an asset who was positioned to yield a bonanza return of fruitful votes for years to come. One donor explained Barr this way for New York Times journalist Eric Lipton. It's almost like investing in a first-round draft pick for the NBA or NFL. There is a potential there, so we make an investment, and we are hopeful that investment produces a return. Andy soon made his investors look clever, providing a quick return on their initial outlay of $151,200 in campaign donations. Although he campaigned as a fiscal prude, Congressman Barr committed to donors by his first April in office to sponsor a financial industry tax loophole law that would deepen the deficit by $500 million annually. Even better, the promising rookie introduced legislation to unwind a portion of the Dodd-Frank re-regulation law that prohibits financial institutions from lending to unqualified homebuyers. The ambitious young man either didn't know or didn't care that such predatory subprime loans were a major cause of the Great Recession a few years earlier. Congressman Barr is far from being alone in trading away the public interest and common sense in exchange for cash. Another promising investment by banking industry lobbyists is Congresswoman Ann Wagner of Missouri. In appreciation for their contributions, she sponsored legislation to derail the Obama administration fiduciary rule, protecting consumers. It required life insurance and financial brokers selling financial products to put their clients' interests ahead of their own. Such protections are commonplace in every other wealthy democracy. The Obama White House Council of Economic Advisors found that Americans pay $17 billion annually in excess broker commissions because brokers put their own financial interests first. Even so, the Trump administration protected the scam by financial advisors, torpedoing the reform proposed by the Obama administration, just as Wagner and the financial industry wanted. Barr and Wagner are part of a wave of politicians with, well, Randian views toward public service, who have entered politics over the last two decades. They are willing to spend 4 hours daily in a cubicle for half the week phoning strangers for money. Their most receptive targets are upper-income Americans across the nation and corporate officers hoping to influence lawmakers to enhance profits by lowering taxes, suppressing wages, and the like. And their soulmates are Roberts Republicans. Decriminalizing vote buying. The Roberts Republicans contend the vast bulk of political contributions and third-party independent expenditures on behalf of lawmakers are not corruption, but embody a central feature of democracy. In their view, a donation reciprocated by an explicit quid pro quo, say, a government contract, constitutes corruption. But donations to acquire as yet unspecified future benefits from the same lawmaker, such as a supported vote on favored legislation, are instead a central feature of democracy. Fordham Law professor Zephyr Teachout argues that this definitional legerdemain is bedeviled by problems and confusion. Subsequent judicial decisions are unclear about the meaning of explicit and how the quid pro quo requirement is defined. Nearly 25 years later, it is still not clear exactly what kind of campaign exchange constitutes a violation. The decriminalization of cash given to or spent on behalf of politicians ignores the intent of donors to buy votes. Donors always and everywhere intend to influence the recipient's viewpoint. That is why Judge Posner described the legislative system as one of quasi-bribery. The late Democratic Senator Russell B. Long was more, well, measured in his assessment. Almost a hairline's difference separates bribes and contributions. Justice Kennedy dismissed those sentiments, asserting in the majority opinion of Citizens United that there is only scant evidence that independent expenditures ever ingratiate. There was one Republican Supreme Court justice during the Buckley era who disputed Kennedy and the Roberts Republicans. In her opinion, in McConnell v. FEC, 2003, then-Justice Sandra Day O'Connor wrote, "We have recognized a concern not confined to bribery of public officials, but extending to the broader threat from politicians too compliant with the wishes of large contributors. Many of the deeply disturbing examples of corruption cited by this court were not episodes of quid pro quo vote-buying, but evidence that various corporate interests had given substantial donations to gain access to high-level government officials." Justice Kennedy's interpretation of the First Amendment would render Congress powerless to address these more subtle but equally dispiriting forms of corruption. Just as troubling to a functioning democracy as classic quid pro quo corruption is the danger that office holders will decide issues not on the merits or the desires of their constituencies, but according to the wishes of those who have made large financial contributions valued by the office holder. Even if it occurs only occasionally, the potential for such undue influence is manifest. There is only scant evidence that independent expenditures ever ingratiate. This Kennedy quote, a pillar of the Buckley genre, collapses under close scrutiny. Both independent expenditures and campaign contributions have repeatedly been demonstrated to induce favorable voting by legislators, the process responsible for the income bias. University of Chicago law professor Nicholas A. Stephanopoulos notes, "There is near consensus in the empirical literature that politicians' positions more accurately reflect the view of their donors than those of their constituents. Moreover, business donors occasionally misspeak by publicly revealing that contributions are intended to buy votes." The National Association of Home Builders Political Action Committee, BuildPAC, for instance, ceased donating to Congress for a period in 2008 in a peak at congressional failure to reciprocate its donations by increasing housing subsidies. Its criticism inadvertently leaked to the press, causing campaign finance expert Kenneth Gross to note, This highly visible carrot-and-stick approach to the use of PAC contributions displays a disquieting nexus between lobbying and political contributions. A second exposé occurred 3 years later at New York State. A trade association solicited $10,000 from each of its members. The plea explained, "Our future ability to adopt favorable legislation, stop terrible legislation, or modify legislation to limit the pain to our industry is directly tied to our continued positive relationship with all the leaders in Albany." Anecdotal evidence is buttressed by donors such as then-candidate Trump, who described the political contributions he made in the course of his career as investments. "When I need something from them 2 years later, 3 years later, I call them." This process of investing in politicians, as practiced by Trump and by bankers donating to Barr or Wagner, was generalized by professors Jennifer Brown, Catherine Drake, and Laura Wellman in the American Accounting Association journal This Way in 2015. Proactive firms build relationships with policymakers through continued campaign support, with the expectation of gaining some economic benefit. Indeed, if contributions or independent expenditures on behalf of politicians did not influence them, they would not occur. It would simply be foolish for corporations or billionaires to donate to politicians, much less to both candidates, as some do. In particular, worldly and canny billionaire campaign contributors such as Sheldon Adelson and the Koch brothers would be fools. Whatever you may think of CEOs or the Fittest 50, they are not fools. They view spending on politicians such as Barr like any other investment. A return is expected, as explained by lobbyist Teresa Kostreva in September 2015. "Donors are demanding a lot these days, man, and they want answers, and they want results. Donors consider a contribution like, 'Well, wait, I just invested in you. Now I need to have my say. You need to answer to me.'" The Roberts Republican's Pollyanna-ish perspective on political spending is belied by the income bias, by the opinion of retired Justice O'Connor, and by the billions of dollars invested in public officials by S&P 500 firm CEOs, the Waltons, the Kochs, and others of the Fittest 50. Further, there is a 40-year skein of scholarly studies providing evidence that donations and third-party independent expenditures sway legislators. The effectiveness of such vote buying has been documented for a wide variety of economic public policy issues, including derailing minimum wage increases. Researchers Jonathan Silverman and Gary Durden, 1976, trucking deregulation, John Frandreis and Richard Waterman, 1985, and telecom industry deregulation, Ruy de Figueiredo and Jeff Edwards, 2005. The digitization of statistical databases has added considerable heft and breadth to this body of work in recent years, with analyses definitively documenting causal linkages between political spending and changes in voting behavior by lawmakers and judges. Examples include a 2015 analysis in the Journal of the American Accounting Association by Jennifer Brown, Catherine Drake, and Laura Wellman concluded that targeted corporate donations to congressional lawmakers sitting on tax law committees, Senate Finance and House Ways and Means Committee members during the 2000s lowered firm-specific future expected tax rates an average 1.66% for an average enterprise tax savings of $33 million. That is an astronomical investment return for a slew of four-digit personal and PAC donations. Finance professors Rand Duchin and Dennis Saussure parsed the link between corporate donations prior to 2008 and the allocation of the $205 billion in Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, bank bailout subsidies that year. "We find that banks' political ties played a significant role in TARP fund distribution. The TARP investment amounts are positively related to banks' political contributions and lobbying expenditures. The estimated magnitudes of political influence are substantial. A bank's connection to a House member on key finance committees is associated with an 18.2% increase in TARP funds, controlling for other factors." Journalist Stephen Brill, founder of American Lawyer magazine, examined the consequences of $15 million in donations from hedge funds and other money managers intended to dilute the Obama administration's Dodd-Frank re-regulation legislation. His July 2010 analysis found that the largesse induced members of Congress to insert a number of loopholes in Dodd-Frank, saving the industry an estimated $10 billion in taxes annually. That translates to an astronomical return, he calculated, of 660%. U.S. multinationals in the mid-2000s were refusing to repatriate billions of dollars in profits held in foreign banks in order to avoid paying the U.S. 35% corporate income tax rate. Corporate contributions induced Congress and the George W. Bush administration to open a temporary tax loophole in 2005, momentarily cutting rates for such repatriations to 5.25%. Corporations took quick advantage of the loophole to repatriate $312 billion in profits, saving over $90 billion in taxes. Economists at the University of Kansas concluded the loophole returned $220 for every lobbying dollar spent. A replay of this lush scenario is a likely element in Trump administration tax changes. Vote buying is also bipartisan. In a study for the National Bureau of Economic Research in April 2017, Jeffrey Brown and Jaekun Huang found that meetings by senior corporate officials with key White House Obama administration policymakers from 2009 through 2015 were associated with more government contracts, regulatory relief, and abnormal stock returns. They also found, following the 2016 election of Donald Trump, that firms with access to the Obama administration experience significantly lower stock returns than otherwise similar firms. Stratman. Donations by congressional votes on agriculture commodity subsidies. Economist Thomas Stratman conducted an expansive statistical analysis in 1990 that documented the purchase of votes in the House of Representatives regarding agricultural commodity price supports, subsidies. This is an unusually powerful data set because there are affluent donors on both sides of such votes, such as sugar growers opposed by confectionery and other industries favoring lower sweetener prices. Moreover, examining the impact of donations utilizing commodity subsidy votes is a particularly revealing analysis because most House members have few, if any, constituents directly connected with commodity price supports. They are essentially nonpartisan free votes for most lawmakers, making the influence of donors relatively transparent. Stratman began with a database of individual members' historic congressional voting behaviors. He then evaluated their reaction to donations by PACs representing growers. Compared to historic vote patterns, such donations switched an average 23.8 votes to yes, aye, on each of the 10 agriculture price support subsidy bills he examined. On three of the bills, political donations swayed sufficient votes to determine the final outcome. See chart 7.1. For instance, a vote to continue dairy subsidies, favored by farmers, passed the House by a count of 245 to 167 in 1990. Had the dairy industry not made campaign contributions in the several years prior to the vote, or had their contributions been neutralized by contributions from opponents, past individual voting histories predicted that the outcome would have been a vote of 204 to 208, killing dairy price supports. Similarly, Stratman found that a vote to continue sugar subsidies, enacted by a margin of 267 to 146, would have failed by a projected vote of 194 to 219 in the absence of political spending by sugar beet and cane growers. Donations switched the votes of 73 members of Congress on that one. Stratman also discovered that lawmaker votes are sold pretty darn cheaply. A $3,000 sugar pack contribution maps into a yes vote with almost certainty.
Buying courtroom verdicts. The vast majority of judicial verdicts in America are rendered in state and local courts,
and nearly 90% of the judges in those courts are elected. This pervasive reliance on elections to select state and local jurists stands in sharp contrast with the practice of other wealthy democracies, where judges are appointed on merit and are nonpartisan. Indeed, judges abroad are on a much more demanding, professionalized career track. Retired Supreme Court Justice O'Connor explains why other nations reject American-style judicial elections. No other nation in the world does that, because they realize they're not going to get fair and impartial judges that way. Traditionally, U.S. judicial elections have been modest affairs. But like state and local legislative elections, that has changed in recent years. Supreme Court justices in Florida, for instance, raised a total of just $7,500 between 2000 and 2010 for their elections, and most races were uncontested. In 2014 alone, however, the three judges seeking re-election raised $1.5 million in donations. More than $2.6 million was spent on electioneering to fill an open Supreme Court seat in Wisconsin in April 2016. And judges in Ohio now routinely raise millions of dollars for their election. Contributions and independent expenditures by favor seekers involving judicial races have soared for two reasons. First, Republican politicians since 2010 in some states have run afoul of state courts that have opposed GOP budget cuts, especially for public education. In Kansas, for instance, tax-cutting Republicans in control of the state government reduced inflation-adjusted per-student spending statewide by 16.5% between 2008 and 2014. Concerned parents sued, and the state Supreme Court judged that the size and distribution of the cuts, with wealthy suburbs protected, violated the state constitution. The governor and legislators refused court orders to ameliorate the cuts. Frustrated with their recalcitrance, the state Supreme Court threatened to close all public schools until lawmakers enacted remedies. That put GOP Governor Sam Brownback and the legislature in the awkward position of having to raise taxes and education spending, offending the Kochs, their neighboring donors headquartered in Wichita. They chose instead to mimic the Turkish autocrat Recep Erdogan and the extreme-right Polish Law and Justice political party by seeking removal of the disfavored judges. Kansas GOP lawmakers opposed the re-election of Supreme Court justices in 2016 and also voted to strip the court of power to rule on the constitutionality of education spending. Kansans are pretty conservative, but even they were disappointed with the GOP lawmakers, voting 14 of them out of office in the August 2016 primaries. Previously, only three GOP incumbents had been ousted in 16 years. In November 2016, voters re-elected all the pro-education state Supreme Court justices and replaced 13 Republican state lawmakers with Democrats. Chastened lawmakers joined with Democrats to reverse most of the income tax cuts at the root of the problem in June 2017. Even so, Kansas income taxes retained their Republican flavor. The poorest will be paying more than twice the share of their income in taxes, 11.8%, as the richest 1% of Kansans pay 4.8%. Second, interest groups, including corporations, have come to appreciate the windfalls on offer from buying favorable court rulings. Judicial vote buying has paid off spectacularly in some instances. West Virginia Supreme Court Justice Brent Benjamin cast the deciding vote absolving the Massey Coal Company of negligence for miner deaths after receiving its $3 million campaign donation. That instance of vote buying was subsequently held to be constitutional by the Roberts Republicans. Voters took a dimmer view of the corruption than the Roberts Republicans, however, defeating Benjamin's bid for re-election in 2016. Another example is Illinois Supreme Court Judge Lloyd Carmier. He cast the deciding vote to overturn a $1.18 billion appellate court verdict, Avery v. State Farm, against the State Farm Insurance Firm, after receiving that firm's $1.35 million donation. Such incidents have become sufficiently commonplace for the American Bar Association to contend that there is a pervasive public perception that campaign contributions influence judicial decision-making. And surveys support that contention. Polling by the Brennan Center for Justice in October 2013, for instance, found that 87% of Americans believe contributions and independent political issue advertising involving judicial candidates has some or a great deal of influence on court rulings. Indeed, surveyed separately and anonymously, nearly one half of the polled judges themselves agreed that rulings are sold at auction. These contentions and perceptions are supported by facts. A variety of scholarly analyses have documented extensive vote buying by litigants before state courts, including, in 2013, law professor Joanna Shepherd examined 175,000 donations to state Supreme Court judges nationwide and found that elected judges chronically favor donors. As the share of contributions to judges from business interests rose from 1% to 50% of all donations received, for instance, the likelihood of the typical judge rendering pro-business rulings rose by 42 percentage points. Any firm, and especially those whose business model skirts regulations or the law, would be foolish indeed not to invest in a clutch of judges. It is also revealing that judges on the verge of retirement abandon their donors. In a separate study, Shepherd and co-author Michael Kang discovered, in the last term before mandatory retirement, the favoritism toward business litigants by judges facing partisan and nonpartisan elections essentially disappears. The Center for American Progress examined the impact of pay-to-play on judicial rulings in states electing judges in the wake of Citizens United. It concluded, in the span of a few short years, big business succeeded in transforming courts such as the Texas and Ohio Supreme Courts into forums where individuals face steep hurdles to holding corporations accountable. In an analysis of the Ohio Supreme Court published in 2006, covering about 1,500 contested cases, a New York Times investigation documented that donors bought judicial rulings. Its justices routinely sat on cases after receiving campaign contributions from the parties involved or from groups that filed supporting briefs. On average, they voted in favor of contributors 70% of the time. One justice voted in favor 91% of the time. The justices almost never disqualified themselves from hearing their contributors' cases. Palmer and Levendis. Donations by judicial rulings. Over a 14-year period, 1992 to 2006, Tulane Law professor Vernon Valentine Palmer and Loyola University professor John Levendis reviewed donor records and ensuing judicial decisions involving the seven Louisiana State Supreme Court justices. The scholars began with a statistical baseline, revealing the justices' history of favoring plaintiffs or defendants in cases not involving contributors. About one half of all cases did not involve contributors, and the justices tended to favor defendants in slightly more than one half, 53% of those rulings, as reproduced in Chart 7.2. The remainder were cases where at least one litigant or their litigator was a donor, but justices did not recuse. They almost never recused. The presence of donors as party to suits significantly changed voting behavior. When a preponderance of contributions had been received from the defendant's side, judges favored defendants in 67% of their rulings. But when plaintiffs were the dominant donors, the judges supported defendants only 39% of the time. Overall, Palmer and Levendis determined that buying judicial rulings was a sound investment. Political spending increased the bribers' odds of favorable court rulings by 26%. The data indicate that judicial voting favors plaintiffs' or defendants' positions not on the basis of judicial leaning or philosophical orientation, but on the basis of the size and timing of a political donation. Palast. Judges acknowledge a pay-to-play judicial system. On behalf of the reform group Justice at Stake, attorney Jerry Palast compiled results from a 2002 survey by the Greenberg Quinlan Rosner research firm. The survey included 2,428 judges serving on state supreme courts, appellate courts, and lower courts, nearly all subject to election. The survey was anonymous. The responses revealed that a huge share of judges anonymously believed pay-to-play has created a two-tier American judicial system at the state level. 81% were concerned that America has one judicial system for the wealthy and powerful and another for everyone else. As reproduced in Chart 7.3, 46% of the justices candidly acknowledged that judicial votes are influenced by donors. Some 57% admitted to anxiety about obtaining sufficient donations in election years. And 84% acknowledged that special interest groups, corporations, and individuals use donations to influence judges and shape public policy. Some 56% of the judges agreed anonymously that judges should be prohibited from presiding over and ruling in cases where one of the sides has given money to their campaign. Recusal is not a remedy. The pervasiveness of vote buying means that recusal is not a feasible remedy to judicial bribery. Requiring recusal is popularly viewed as the solution to judicial pay-to-play. A Marist poll, for example, found that 87% of New Yorkers favored judicial recusal in instances involving donors that were litigants in a suit. And the survey noted earlier, conducted for the Brennan Center during October 2013, found an even larger 92% of respondents believed when one party in a court case has either donated directly to a judge's campaign or spent significantly on election materials designed to help elect the judge should step aside. Finally, in the analysis of the Ohio Supreme Court noted earlier, covering about 1,500 contested cases, the authors concluded, in the 12 years that were studied, the justices almost never disqualified themselves from hearing their contributors' cases. In the 215 cases with the most direct potential conflicts of interest, for example, justices recused themselves just 9 times. Unfortunately, the prevalence of lax ethical standards has caused vote buying to become so embedded in state-level jurisprudence that recusal is now impractical. The Ohio Supreme Court justices participating in the 2006 study explained that requiring recusal in suits involving donor litigants would be a recipe for havoc, leaving far too few judges left to man courtrooms. The only feasible remedy is to bring a halt to the election of judges. As we see next, the broad pattern of widespread vote buying that involves lawmakers and judges has sown deep cynicism about American democracy.